You are tuned into Lightly on the Ground Radio on WRIR-LP 97.3 and worldwide at WRIR.org. We're exploring our food system, which the Food and Nutrition Information Center of the USDA's National Agricultural Library describes as everything from farm to table. It extends from a seed in a farmer's hand to a bill in the hands of those making policy on the local, national, and worldwide front. I am Sunny Gardner, and our guest today in the live room at Richmond Independent Radio is Dr. Alan Straw. Dr. Straw works with Virginia Cooperative Extension as an area specialist in horticulture, small fruit, and specialty crops. His home base is the Southwest District Office in Glade Spring, Virginia. Welcome to Lightly on the Ground Radio, Dr. Straw. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Yeah, thanks. It looks like your work keeps you on the front line of pest and weed control.
Yeah, unfortunately and fortunately, we live in the hot, humid southeastern U.S., and we have lots of weather that promotes weeds and insects and diseases in the southeast. So,
yeah.
You know, unlike other parts of the country, we don't have as much cold weather to kill off populations of insects, and diseases kind of get started here pretty early in the season and can stay, so we get to battle them all the time.
Yeah, and our crops grow well, too.
Yes, they do.
Nice climate. Nice climate, yeah. So you do practical research on a broad variety of plants. Do you work on a research farm, or do you work with farmers, actually?
Both. We actually have some agricultural research and extension centers across the Commonwealth, but and there is research, obviously, conducted on those. But a lot of mine I try to do on-farm with growers, because it's you actually see how things perform and work in real-life situations. The other thing that really makes it handy is those growers usually will do a lot of the maintenance on the crop, so it's easier for me. I don't have to have as much help and hire help to do the work that would take place on a research station.
Oh, okay. Well, I saw an article about one of your projects, which was weed control in pumpkins.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to me because I saw that you were testing various herbicides and I believe methods as well. But you had these tables where it talked about the cost of various things. And I tell us a little bit about that, about what the economic impact is of using herbicides and various types of...
Well, you know, this year I did some more work like that, and basically what I tried to do with that was do it on different growers' farms where I was doing variety trials also. And it was nice because one situation was no-till into maybe a rye or wheat cover crop. Another situation was no-till into a wheat cover crop. And then another situation, it was conventional. The soil had been worked and then planted, and then so we can see how the herbicides react under those different environmental conditions and the different cultural practices in the production. Basically, what we're trying to do is, you know, if you don't control the weeds in a pumpkin crop, you can probably reduce yields by at least 50 to 75%. The pumpkins are smaller. They typically are more diseased because of, usually you have stress for competition for light, you have stress on the plant from competition from moisture from the weeds, and you have usually more disease because of when you have that weed, you have a really heavy canopy and they don't dry out. The plants don't dry out, the fruit doesn't dry out, so we usually have a lot more disease issues. You also usually have more problems because the insects, if you have a lot of heavy weed pressure and you don't spray for insects to control them, usually you'll have a lot more insect pressure in that area. And then if you get certain insects, you'll have more disease because those insects vector the diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal is to find, you know, affordable, inexpensive products that will help control the weeds in the pumpkins without detrimental effect to the pumpkin and obviously without leaving residues in the food. And my personal research doesn't get into the residue part, but I do work with the organization, the IR4, which is a regional project started in the 60s that looks at labeling crop products for minor use crops. And so they do a lot of the residue testing for these minor use crops so that we can get the use of a new insecticide or a new fungicide or a new herbicide in things like pumpkins, which are not a major crop, you know, and major companies aren't willing to put forth the money to label that product for something that they never get the return back out of. And so IR4 works with that.
Well, now we hear about the chemicals that are being, you can use chemicals now that will not damage crops because of genetic engineering.
Yes.
There's a situation with Monsanto, and I believe you have to buy this whole suite of seeds and chemicals together. So you spray the field, plant the crop, spray the field again, and it kills all of the weeds. Mm-hmm. And leaves the plant alive because of the gene that's in the plant that is resistant to glyphosate.
That's correct.
Or Roundup.
Right.
Are there residues from that? How does that sort of chemical and that sort of system interact with the soil and the life, and are there residues as well?
Well,
it's a very general question, but tell me about that.
Well, basically, though, Roundup, if I understand Roundup correctly, or glyphosate actually doesn't kill the plant. Glyphosate weakens the plant, and it blocks metabolic pathways inside the plant that the plant is able to resist diseases and so forth. And if I understand the mode of action is basically published by one of the former professors at Purdue, that basically when you spray glyphosate on a weed, on any plant, the natural tendency is the plant takes it up through the leaves and then through the xylem, through the phloem, I believe, through the stem, moves it to the root system. Mm-hmm. And at that point, and it also goes to the growing point of the plant. It goes to the actively growing points of the plant. And then that glyphosate weakens the plant. It acts as a chelating agent, it's a chelating agent. It binds with the zinc and the calcium and the different metals, mm-hmm, inside the plant and makes them unavailable and blocks the pathway of basically the plant becomes susceptible to disease. So over a period of time then, organisms like Fusarium, Rhizoctonia, Pythium, Phytophthora actually then attack the plant and kill the plant. And what happens in the case of the Roundup Ready gene is that the Roundup Ready gene puts a secondary pathway in the plant which allows the plant that's resistant to the glyphosate the ability to still manufacture the products it's needed to make it live and resist those pathogens. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is that we have weeds now, and this is one of my concerns with Roundup Ready technology, is that we have weeds that are resistant to that product now.
How did that happen?
Well, I think there were already probably products that are weeds that were resistant are tolerant to it. Mm-hmm. There are several of the what we call pigweed or amaranths that were resistant to it. Mare's tail had a natural tendency not to be killed by it very well.
Well, it's a broadleaf herbicide, isn't it?
It's broad spectrum. It kills grasses and weeds.
Oh, okay.
But broadleaf weeds. But there were some plants that just inherently were not controlled well by Roundup even before this technology all took place. Mm-hmm. And just like anything, whenever you start using it over and over and over, through selection, plants are able to say, hey, their genes build resistance if we use something too much. And that's been one of my biggest fears when we've went to this technology is overuse and building resistance.
Hmm. There's a new product that is up for approval or deregulation through the USDA. There's Dow AgroScience is seeking approval for a corn that is resistant to herbicides that normally kill both broadleaf and grass herbicides. And it's actually a 2,4-D product, which is a component of the defoliant called Agent Orange back
in the
60s. Well,
it wasn't a component. It was like a cousin molecule. Mm-hmm. The actual product was 2,4-5-T that was in Agent Orange. Mm-hmm. 2,4-D is another product. It's similar. They're in the phenoxy class of herbicides. And basically what they do is they make the plant grow real fast, and they're growth regulators, and the cell walls rupture and it kills the plant. But yes, there is that. That is one of the components of the of what Dow is asking for.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard that it would enable us to use more of this chemical 2,4-D, which has been shown to cause reproductive immune system and neurotoxin activity in humans as it's moved up the food chain.
Well, I'll have to be honest. I don't know how much that happens. 2,4-D is used some now. Mm-hmm. I can remember using it as a child. You know, I grew up on a grain and livestock farm in East Central Illinois, and I actually remember getting sprayed with it by my grandfather.
Oh, just for fun?
No, accidentally.
Like, oh, okay.
You know, the sprayer left the boom up, you know, and we accidentally got sprayed one day, you know. And I don't know of any problem that, yeah. You know, honestly, that, and I know there are reports of neurological issues mm-hmm. with, especially 2,4-5-T. Mm-hmm. I know there's been a lot of issues there left over from Vietnam and continued exposure to Agent Orange. But as far as 2,4-D itself, I'm not aware of that many issues with it. And honestly, what my understanding of the gene is that the gene is not, you know, we already can use it in corn. It's labeled for corn. It just makes the corn a little more resistant to it. So that, for instance, 2,4-D is labeled in sweet corn. We can use it on sweet corn up to a certain stage. Mm-hmm. But if it gets too tall and we spray it with 2,4-D, then it will make the corn stalk brittle, and then the corn breaks off and falls over, or it falls over and gets brittle. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want it to... my understanding of what's happening with this product is it just allows you to have a little more safety when you use it, and that will allow you to maybe use it a little later in the season when we wouldn't normally be able to because of the issue with the brittle stalks. Mm-hmm. And the real reason, from what I understand, why Dow is wanting to add this is back to the resistant weed issues with glyphosate. We have products like, or weeds like mare's tail. And mare's tail is a biennial crop, if I'm not mistaken, or biennial weed, that grows throughout the late winter, early spring. And it actually even can come up as a rosette in the fall, mm-hmm. late winter, and then, you know, in the spring it comes up, becomes a tall plant.
Yeah.
And the problem that we run into is glyphosate. It's resistant to glyphosate, and has been for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And so 2,4-D is one of the products that a lot of growers like to put in the herbicide mixture to kill that. And with corn, it's not as much of an issue at that time of year, but like for other, maybe like soybeans, you know, you can't use 2,4-D because it will damage the soybean plant. But they are, my understanding is they're wanting this technology so they can tank mix the glyphosate and the 2,4-D as a burn down in the spring of the year to control mare's tail, or like during the season, if you do get mare's tail escapes, then they can spray 2,4-D later in the season than they typically could without this GMO corn or without this genetically altered corn.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any evidence or read anything about the effect that genetically modified plants, say in a crop rotation such as soybean, wheat, and corn, has on the soil and the soil life?
Well, that's a very good question, because I was made aware about a year ago of some research that had come out of Purdue. I think it was published in, it was originally written in 2009, but I understand it's just recently been released and now published. A researcher, and I believe his name was Don Huber at Purdue University, had found some interesting issues in the soil with glyphosate. And, he calls it almost a mono herbicidal mode production system. Now we have monoculture, but now we have a mono herbicide system. We come in and we basically can spray cornfield or a soybean field three times during the season with glyphosate and try to kill all the weeds and control all the weeds. And his findings, and I will back up and say there are a plethora of reports out there that show that there are little or no effects of glyphosate on microbial activity and on the life in the soil. But Don Huber's work now has shown that there is, it does kill earthworms, that it does actually persist in the soil for possibly 8 to 10 years, it and or its metabolites, and there is one metabolite of glyphosate that is still active even in the soil as it begins to break down. It has still has herbicidal characteristics, and as he calls it, microbicidal activity. There are also some things that are going on with micronutrients, and most of that's believed to be either from chelation with the glyphosate molecule or with the fact that some of the microbes are killed in the soil, and so therefore nutrients that are normally available to the plant are maybe tied up or not as available to the plant because those microorganisms aren't there, you know, doing their job and making the nutrients available to the plant.
So let me make sure I understand is in the rhizosphere around the roots of the plants, there's always these microbes that are mm-hmm. actually breaking down and submitting the nutrients to the plant. And this glyphosate molecule is chelating the minerals that the microbes might actually normally be using and making them unavailable to the microbes to feed the plant.
Yeah, and like I say, it's actually a twofold thing. It is toxic, appears to be the glyphosate and one of its metabolites appears to actually be toxic to earthworms and some of the, like the rhizobium, which produces nitrogen, you know, mm-hmm. on legume crops.
Yeah.
It also appears to chelate your metals. It chelates things like calcium and magnesium and copper and iron and manganese and zinc and nickel. And what we have been seeing, and I had seen this for about 3 years prior to learning of this data, well, 2 years prior to learning of this data, was that in fields where we were doing a lot of Roundup Ready corn, we were seeing visual symptoms of zinc deficiency. And it didn't make sense because we would check the pH of the soil was right. You know, if the pH gets too high, like above 6.5, and if you have a lot of phosphorus in the soil, zinc phosphate forms and becomes unavailable to the plant. And so, you know, most of these fields, the pH was down around 6 to 6.2, which is ideal for corn production. Mm-hmm. You would look at the soil test levels, and the zinc content of the soil was adequate to grow a good crop without what was apparent, you know, without apparent visual symptoms. And to keep in mind that a lot of times micronutrients are silent or invisible hunger signs. You know, a lot of times, you know, you don't see a lot of symptoms with micronutrients until the deficiency becomes really bad. And so, but we were seeing visual symptoms. And so it was really bum-fuzzling to me that we couldn't find, you know, there was plenty in the soil, the pH was right, why were we seeing these symptoms? Mm-hmm. Well, I know other researchers had seen it and growers had seen it, and we started to put together that it seemed like Roundup-resistant or Roundup-ready crops seemed to be showing signs, more symptoms of this than were conventional or non-GMO crops. And so as we got to look, you know, a lot of these people were making at least 2 Roundup applications per season. And so we thought it was just a genetic trait of the crop. And then a year or so ago, like I said, I found out this research had been published that said, wait a minute, you know, the glyphosate is actually tying up the zinc. And I know I was talking with a green bean grower in another state, and they had made the policy change on their farms, even if they were growing green beans or if somebody, you know, if it was in a rotational crop and they were doing corn on it, they were limiting glyphosate to 1 application per season mm-hmm. because they were trying to minimize how much glyphosate got put on the field because they were starting to see some, you know, green beans are very sensitive to zinc. So if you get the zinc tied up, you'll see zinc deficiency in green beans, and then it hurts the production of the crop. Mm-hmm. And so they had made a management decision to limit glyphosate applications to 1 per season on any field. So because they didn't want a buildup of glyphosate and a chelation effect and, you know, killing the microbes to hurt the green bean crop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of these things have long-term effects.
Yeah. And that's very true. You know, and that's one of the things that through the years people felt like, you know, glyphosate went into the soil. When it went into the soil, it was – tied up or broke. Well, actually, it would be bound, but then in the soil it was broken down. Mm-hmm. And again, the work at Purdue has found that basically it isn't broken down. It stays there and can persist for maybe 8 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very long process. And actually, with it being a strong chelator, it binds with the metals in the soil, you know, the zinc and the iron and the copper, mm-hmm. et cetera, that we mentioned earlier, and it's staying there. And that the only way that you can really get rid of it is to maybe put a large dose of calcium in the soil and try to get the calcium to chelate with it. And then over time, then it's broken down and can basically get out of the system.
Well, let's just take a short break.
Chef got stuck in the Ford, got stuck, got the Chevron stuck when the Dodge showed up. But the Dodge got stuck in the tractor rut, which eventually pulled out the Ford. Well, it was truck after truck, we all got stuck, except the big old 4x Hutterite truck. We all thought, Lord, are we in luck, but he wouldn't come anywhere near us. Mighty neighborly, mighty neighborly. We used a lot of our backs and a little of our brains. It jacked up the jacks, it snugged up the chains. We all did our very best to refrain from shoveling. We put what timber we had underneath the wheels, and we was all out of sand, but managed to steal 2 sacks of the best modern canola seed you ever did see. That ought to give us some traction. Chef got stuck in the Ford, got stuck in the Chevron, stuck when the Dodge showed up. But the Dodge got stuck in the tractor rut, which eventually pulled out the Ford. Epilogue. We spilled genetically modified canola seed that was genetically modified for control of the weeds and for big old yields. The margarine oil raised hell all over that native prairie soil. Agriculture Canada is definitely going to be looking for us.
I am Sunny Gardner, and our guest today on Lightly on the Ground Radio is Dr. Alan Straw, and we're discussing the effect of herbicide use on soil life and other things. And that was The Truck Got Stuck by Corb Lund and his band, the Hurtin' Albertans. Did you catch the part about the genuinely genetically modified canola seed being used for traction? The YouTube video is a hoot. Check it out. Corb Lund. Back to our discussion, what is your experience with the long-term effects of these combined chemicals? You're talking about tank mixing, and it seems, you know, just when you take medications, you end up with different side effects and that sort of thing.
Well, my biggest concern, and you had mentioned earlier about the Dow wanting this new product treated as an unregulated. And one of the things that we battle is that we're looking at this product actually makes the corn more resistant to 2,4-D or phenoxy herbicides, but it also makes it resistant to one of the grass herbicides, which is a post-emergence grass herbicide that controls monocot weeds, which is grasses predominantly.
And corn's a grass.
Corn's a grass. And so one of my concerns is now, you know, basically if I'm growing corn, and some of that corn stays out in the field, you know, the stalk falls over, and so then the, you know, ear hits the ground, and next year that seed comes up volunteer, and I'm growing soybeans or wheat or some other crop in that field, then that corn becomes a weed, and that's what the definition of a weed is. It's a plant out of place. Mm-hmm. It's not a corn field now. It's a soybean field or a wheat field. Well, if it's glyphosate-resistant corn, I can't go back across the top of that corn and spray it with glyphosate in the bean field and kill it. Mm-hmm. And so what most growers have had to rely on are post-emergence graminicides, they're called, you know, products that kill grasses after they come up. Mm-hmm. And we have 3 or 4 of them that are very good, and that's what we're using. Well, this product that Dow now is introducing actually contains resistance to one of those graminicides. So now we're going to have a corn that's resistant to a product that normally kills it. And that's not a big deal in some ways, but it is to me because, okay, it's already resistant to glyphosate, and now it's going to be resistant to the graminicide that we use to kill it in glyphosate-resistant corn. So, you know, and that's kind of their goal is they want to stack these genes on top of each other. They want to make it glyphosate-resistant and 2,4-D resistant and fusillade resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have this corn that, how do we kill it?
Nothing will kill it.
Right.
All right. Well, that sounds like a pretty decent reason to not have this corn on the market to me.
Well, you know, I understand that. Or yeah. Why do we have to have that technology? You know, I don't have a problem so much with it's already labeled and we can use the 2,4-D, but why do we need this grass component? I don't understand that. Mm-hmm. That's my concern.
Right. Well, we're coming near the end here, so let me just tell the listeners that particularly about this product, you could go to the USDA's website and look for APHIS, APHIS, the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS, and they have a petition. If you go to the Federal Register and look for Dow corn, you'll come up with this petition, and there's a place right there where your comments can be listed until February 27th of 2012. And I want to thank Dr. Alan Straw for showing up for this interview. And there's a lot more to cover, and I'm going to do a second interview with him about some other subjects that we've touched on just in sitting here talking. Lightly on the Ground Radio is a Sonny Gardner production for Richmond Independent Radio, broadcast on WRIR-LP FM 97.3 and WRIR.org. I want to thank all the volunteers at Richmond Independent Radio, especially engineer Ethan Scott, and our community of members who bought us this equipment for making radio. Go to Facebook, befriend Lightly on the Ground Radio, so you will know who will appear on the show and when podcasts are available. And walk in the light and live lightly on the ground. Thank you for listening.